Hello, everyone, and welcome to the hashtag SDR Ask podcast. I'm Amy Hall, and Greg Kokel is here with me in the studio to answer your questions. Hi, Greg.
We were fussing around just before we came on the air. That's why we're giggling, having a good time here.
Okay, so this first question comes from Anonymous. One of our elders had an adult child, about 20, who says she is starting the process to change genders. She lives about an hour away. How should the church react to her if she shows up? Should this affect her father's position as elder, given 1 Timothy 3:4?
Well, the 1 Timothy 3:4, I think, is the passage that says that if you're going to be an elder, you have to have children that believe and you're ordering your own household well. And since this is an adult child, this is somebody outside of the household, I don't know that that's going to be a factor. Our general approach that we've taken on this, Amy, at Stand to Reason, is that insofar as we encounter people who are experiencing gender confusion, there may be gender dysphoric in some way, which simply means that people are uncomfortable with the gender of their body or the sex of their body, and so they adopt a different gender mentally, as it were. And our general approach has been to go along with the person that we encounter who has a preference for a gender different from their body. And when I say go along, I mean, if you meet somebody, you're not going to say, well, you're not a she, you're a he, and make a big fuss about that. The reason is because it won't accomplish anything good. We don't have a moral obligation to gainsay somebody's faulty gender identity. Okay, when I say faulty, I mean they think they're a woman when their physical gender is a man, and we don't, I don't think, need to gainsay that or deny it. You know, what's the point? It's just causing trouble. We don't do that in other issues. We don't, you know, we make a fuss about things we disagree with, unless it's really vital. And this, I don't think, on an individual basis, is one of those kinds of things. So even though there's part of me that is troubled by the whole trend of gender dysphoria and accommodating it in some way, when it comes to an individual who's experiencing gender dysphoria, if I take exception with that individual, all that appears to be is mean-spirited. And so, you know, Jordan Peterson, when he says on the faculty of the University of in Canada, where's Tim from? Toronto.
I just drew a blank.
Sorry. I mean, there, even he's well known for having said no to this, all of this, this stuff. Well, in that kind of circumstance, it's a little different. Dealing on an individual basis, though, with people, somebody comes to our church and they are adopting a gender other than the sex that they actually are, I don't think it helps anything to make a big deal about it. Rather, I think we should just warmly welcome the individual as they are into our community or into our fellowship at the moment. I actually don't even know what, if that person said they were a Christian, what I would do about it even at that point. And this is where maybe Alan would have some more to contribute on this because he's thought more thoroughly about these. But I think when you have people that are deeply confused and really hurting, I think you have to address that. I don't think it's a sin. I'm trying to maybe I should weigh my words here, but it isn't like it's a sinful behavior, like this is an egregious sin. You think you're a girl, but you're a boy. Okay, we got to discipline that. This isn't helpful, I don't think. Rather, I think it's better to show grace and kindness in that situation. Now, by the way, if there is sexual behavior that is associated with this, that is inappropriate sexual behavior, that's a different matter. Okay? So if somebody is a female, physical body, but transgendered, thinks that she's a male, okay, then if that entails what amounts to homosexual sexual behaviors, that's another matter. So the conduct is a different matter. But the, I mean, my sense right now is if somebody's coming in to our Christian community and this is something they're struggling with, that we don't make life more difficult for them than it already is. The first response in that case, I think, is to love them and to welcome them and then see what happens after that. Doesn't mean that we have to go along with the whole political agenda. That, to me, is a different matter, where society is pressing for this kind of thing, because I think that does bring harm to lots of people when this is encouraged rather than discouraged, okay? But as a social issue and as a policy issue, it's one thing. This is a question about somebody coming into their church who is gender dysphoric or maybe because of that is posing as a or living as a different gender than their physical body, if I'm understanding this correctly.
Well, it says that she's in the process of changing genders. Would you say that...
Oh, a transsexual then?
Yeah, so would you say that that is that's wrong to do? I mean,
yeah,
I would say that's wrong.
Yes, that would be wrong. That's self-mutilatory behavior, you know. So that's getting surgery to make your body look more like the gender you prefer. Of course, a sex change operation, strictly speaking, are impossible because you can never change mm-hmm. your sex. Your sex goes right down through and through to every cell of your body. But, yeah, I think this is a mistake. But, okay, what if somebody, let's just say, for example, somebody's getting radical other kinds of surgery, cosmetic-type surgery, okay? Well, maybe I would think that that's wrong, too. But how do I receive this individual now that they've done that? That's a different kind of question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It doesn't say here if... if she is, actually, does it say it's even a she? Oh, yes. It doesn't say if she says she's a Christian or not
right.
in here. So that's unclear. I think if she's not, then certainly you would treat her just as you would any other person who
any
is not
outsider.
A Christian
right.
who came into your church.
Right.
But if she is, well, so... if she does claim to be a Christian, because there are also things in the New Testament that talk about how you should not fellowship with someone who says they're a Christian and is in some sort of sin. If they're living as the other sex, then that is, I do think that's sinful because you're confusing the genders, you're confusing mm-hmm. God's order. I mean, there's even a verse in the Old Testament
right.
about how you're not supposed to dress up like the opposite
right.
sex.
And so there's a significant value to the distinctiveness between the sexes.
Mm-hmm.
God made them male and female, right?
So do you think there is... I mean, I want you to say that, oh, yes, we should welcome her. That's the much nicer thing, and that's what I want you to say. So I'm hoping you do say that, but maybe... But if she is saying she's a Christian, then would those verses apply where
Well, you're thinking
you
of 1 Corinthians chapter
yeah.
5, and there's a list of things that we're not to associate with any so-called brother or sister who
right.
is involved in these things. Now, of course, it's not just involved in sin, because every Christian is involved in sin
right.
at some level. But these are egregious sins, and you don't just wink at these kinds of things. The difficulty with a sex change operation is it's not reversible. So it isn't like you could say, okay— oh, that's wrong. I'm going to stop doing that thing, like the things that are listed there. And
right.
so I think this makes it more difficult. I'd actually like to hear from more people who've thought about this more deeply than I have, because I think this is the kind of thing, like, what do you how do you deal with somebody who lives in a polygamous community, which happens in other places of the world, like in Africa, and becomes a Christian but has... three wives. Now what? Well, this is really hard now because, you know, monogamy is God's purpose there, but at the same time, divorce, which would be necessary there, two would have to be divorced for that person to be monogamous, and then you're throwing two people out and maybe in a circumstance where they can't be cared for well in that community. So these become much more complex ethical problems to solve. And I think the circumstance that we're talking about now, a transgendered person who is a Christian comes into the church. When I say transgendered, I mean one that has had an operation that alters the body. That's not reversible. So now what? And in some cases, those people are going to kind of in a certain sense, come to their right mind, as it were, and realize they've made a mistake. That happens in some cases. It's tragic that the operation can't be reversed, but in other cases, maybe they won't. And this is where, this is a pastoral question that I don't know the answer to in terms of how you deal with that in a local congregation.
I think regardless, the first thing you talk to her about is Jesus and the gospel. I think you're totally right that you don't lead with your, what you're doing is wrong, because we don't really, we don't interact with people that way normally anyway.
Even when we talk about homosexuality, talking with a homosexual about Christ is the same as talking with any other person about Christ. You don't make that the issue, because if it weren't that, it would be something else. You know, we it isn't that we're guilty of any particular sin. It's that we're sinners and lost regardless of who we are, regardless of what far country we've gone out to. We still have to be restored to the Father, to trade on the parable of the prodigal.
One question I've recommended people ask, if you ask someone, if you really believed that Jesus did not want you to go through an operation, if you honestly believed that he did not want you to, would you follow him or would you go ahead with the operation?
Okay.
I think what that does is it helps them clarify for themselves what's most important. So even without saying, he doesn't say, he says you can't do that. You're just asking yourself, what is most important to you? Would you give that up if you thought Jesus didn't want you to do that?
See, the reason I'm pausing here on this one is that same question could be asked of virtually any sin that a Christian chooses to do.
Well, of course.
So
of course.
But what it shows is that every Christian is divided. You know, this wonderful song, I Surrender All, I can't ever sing that because it's never going to be true of me. It sounds really good, but because there are always these little pockets of autonomy that represent our choices against God's purpose, and we know oftentimes when we're doing that.
But
kind
you
of thing.
aren't just getting carried along going through a sex change process. That's something you can do or not do. It's not something you can't help. That's not just like a sin. Oh, I'm sinning and I can't stop, or I'm. You know what I'm saying?
It's I mean, there are times, to be perfectly candid, and I bet you most people listening can understand it, where we're thinking, you know, I'm not supposed to do that, but I'm going to do it anyway, whatever, you know, whatever it happens to be. So there are occasions like that in all of our lives. I think when you're dealing with a big issue like this, it seems to be in a little different category, but, you know, so then that would be kind of an acid test for you of whether the person's genuinely a Christian if they're saying, I'm going to do it my way, not Jesus' way, in a situation like
that. And
if
for nothing else, it would just clarify for them. They would be able to think about what really are my priorities here. Do I really want to follow Christ at any cost, or am I not there yet, or I don't know. It's just a way to help them to think about.
Sure.
Where they are spiritually.
Yeah, I think it is a valuable question. And I'm not sure, I guess I'm not entirely sure what the answers would actually indicate if they say, well, I want to do this anyway. I mean, I think there are Christians that commit suicide and they're real believers, but they're at the end of their rope and they're not trusting and they know this is wrong, but they're just going to, this is it. And so anyway, sometimes these things are harder, you know. This is what we face when we live in a fallen world.
Yeah,
we face all kinds of difficult circumstances, and this is why. I mean, to me, this is where the grace of God is so important to me. In fact, I was thinking about it this morning. So driving and praying, and you know, I don't want to make this sound too spiritual, but I'm thoughtful in my long drive here to the office, and I'm thinking about some of these conundrums and my own challenges in my own life, and I'm also thinking, you know, I don't know how I'm going to solve this particular problem, but you know what? The grace of God still covers me. However, even if I blunder, I make the wrong choice, or I'm self-willed in a moment, or whatever, the grace of God is still there to cover me, and that's not license. That's not the way I mean to be communicating it. It's the sense that we are fraught with all kinds of difficulties and temptations and hardships, and we want to be on a right trajectory. in the spirit, as it were, rather than in the flesh, as Paul says in Romans 8. And at the same time, there are all kinds of pitfalls, and this is why the grace of God is so important.
And I think one...
You're frowning,
because I'm
thinking,
no, I'm just thinking about this poor guy, like, trying to figure out what to do in this situation. Yeah. I think if you go into it with your highest goal being, I want to do whatever I can to help her see Christ better. That's my goal. And that's my goal, not the purity of I'm doing everything right, or I'm not encouraging this, or I'm making sure she knows I don't like this or whatever. I think if that's your goal, if that's your main concern, I think you're probably more likely to go wrong. But if your main concern is, what I really care right now about is what is best for her and for her to know Christ better and for the truth, but ultimately so that she knows Christ better. But other than that, like, it's
a tough one.
It's, yeah.
So tread lightly.
Hopefully something there helped you.
And wisely, yeah.
All right, here's a question from Will Black.
I hope it's easier than the last one.
Is the phrase / concept, you can't love people before you learn to love yourself first, true?
It is. Well, I want to say it's true. But, of course, that depends on what one means by the words. And the way this one was stated, I can't agree with it. All right. Because he said you need to learn to love yourself first. Now, there's a psychological tell right there. That is communicating something about a certain psychological perspective. Jesus said we should love others as we love ourselves. He doesn't say that we learn to love ourselves, and then when we know what it feels like to love ourselves, then we start loving other people in the way that we love ourselves, because that puts us first when it's stated that way, and other people second. First me. Let me first learn to love myself. Well, that's going to take a while. I'll work on it. Jesus is making the exact opposite point. He's saying, take your eyes off of yourself and put it on someone else. Now, I think the way C.S. Lewis unpacked this is sound. And simply put, that loving oneself means, how do we love ourselves? He says, does it mean that I always feel good about myself? No. Does it mean that I always like myself? No. What does it mean? Well, we seek our own benefit. That's the natural thing, to seek our own good. And so what Lewis says is what Jesus is saying here is that we should seek the other person's good the way we seek our own good. And that's a way of loving them as we are loving ourselves. Now, that to me makes perfect sense. But when this other psychological maneuver comes in here, the self-love, the 60s, 70s self-love deal, you know, I'm okay, you're okay, you know, kind of deal. It was the title of a book in probably the early 70s. This whole thing came out of the 60s, the self-love deal and the self-esteem movement. Well, now Jesus' words get perverted. I can't love you the way Jesus said, unless I focus on loving me for a while. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to get really good at that so I can get later sometime, that'll never come, get good at loving you. It's all backwards and upside down. That's importing fad psychology and bad psychology, I should say, not virtuous psychology, into this whole enterprise of Jesus' command. Lewis is right. I think what Jesus is asking us to do is whatever goodwill we seek for ourselves, whatever good we do, we try to project that onto others. We do that for others. Jesus, rather, Paul's way of putting it is in Philippians 2. He said, don't seek after your own interests, but consider other people's interests as more important than your own. Because look what Jesus did. Jesus, though he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped and held onto, but he humbled himself, became a bondservant. There you go. There it is, Philippians chapter 2. And we see Jesus' comments from the gospel. They do not fit the way that is specifically worded. Mm-hmm. We don't have to learn to love ourselves in the way Jesus is talking about. That's pop psychology. We already do love ourselves way too much. We should deny ourselves, not feed our self-love, and we should put the attention on other people. That's what's virtuous and meritorious mm-hmm. about the directive of Jesus and repeated in other words by Paul in Philippians 2, in my humble opinion.
Well, thank you, Greg. All right, we're out of time. Thank you, everyone, for sending us your questions. Please keep sending those to us on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.